It's Saturday morning. It's 10 o'clock. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
And I'm Adam Van Wee.
And we are here on yet another of Northeast Florida's wonderful days. It is June. It's getting warmer, a little more humid. Got to expect that. Much better for beach time, though. So you can always look at the fun side. Want everybody who was a regular, welcome back. You know, we've been counting on you for a long time here in our 10th year. And we hope we never let you down, because you don't let us down. If you're new to the show, stick around and see what happens, and maybe you'll just learn something today. That would be very nice. I do have a personal note quickly. I was listening to Angela on the way in here, and a friend of the show, multiple caller, multiple winner, Mike, lost his companion at 29 years on Memorial Day. And we wanted to say our condolences in person to you, Mike. Sorry about that. Anyway, back to business. Money. Everybody likes some more money better than less money, the first rule of money. So we have it after this last week, a little bit more money than before. It was a decent week. Didn't end real well, but it didn't end real badly either.
So. No, it was, at least on the surface, it was a good week. All three of the major indexes were up, but there was some underlying weaknesses, and I'll get to that in a minute, right after I go over the results. But the Dow added 0.3%, the S&P was up 1.3%, and then the NASDAQ kind of surged ahead another 2.4%. It's been a really good year, unless you're invested in Dow stocks, small caps, mid caps, or the S&P equal weight index.
And who isn't?
Yeah, those are a part of almost everyone's portfolio. Not necessarily the equal weight index, but the Dow stocks are in just about everyone's. Small and mid caps are in just about everyone's. But it's funny, because if you just look at the NASDAQ and the S&P, we are having a great year. But then you start looking around, and it's not as great as it may look on the surface. The S&P is up just over 12% this year. But if you look at the S&P equal weight index, it's up just 4.7. What does that mean? That means that there are large or mega cap stocks that are really pulling up that index. And when the index is cap weighted, so the larger stocks have an outsized influence on the performance of that index. So when you put it in equal weight, it doesn't look so good, because the bottom 80% of the index hasn't done that well. And so you're seeing a lot of articles come out right now that say that there's the market doesn't really look as good as it looks. And I can't say I disagree with that, but that doesn't mean that the market is poised to go down. In fact, a lot of times when this happens, the market actually outperforms in the short term. Now, in the 12-month range, the results are a lot more varied, but in the short term, it actually tends to be good. It's kind of counterintuitive. But of course, when you're writing a business article that's going on MarketWatch or Yahoo Finance, you want to, of course, present the worst case scenario. So you say, oh, there's trouble in the market, and it doesn't look good. But don't believe that. It's not necessarily the case. All it takes is a couple week rally in all of the underperforming areas, which are much better bargains than the part of the market that's doing really well. And suddenly you've got a really robust, fully functioning bull market type of market on your hands. So it really can change in a hurry. I wouldn't get too worried about this yet. I did want to talk about small caps. They were down 2.5% this week and are now down almost 1% this year. Mid caps were down 2% this week and are up just 5.7% this year. Another area I didn't mention was value stocks. Value stocks are only up about 4 or 5% this year, whereas growth stocks are up 13, 14 or higher this year. So there's a lot of disparity between mid and small caps and large caps, and then between growth and value. But that's the thing. Whenever you see that happen, one of those things looks like a much better value and tends to get bought up at some point. But we don't know when that will be. Inside the sectors of the S&P, there was a very wide range of results this week. Utilities were down 3.8%. Energy was down 3.4%. On the other side, technology was up 2.6, healthcare was up 1.9, and communication services was up 1.4. That's a spread of 5.2% in performance between the best performing sector and the worst performing sector. That's a pretty big spread in a week. Year to date, there are just two sectors that are down. One is real estate, that's off 4.6%. And the other is consumer discretionary, and that's off just 0.4%. Otherwise, the overall performance of the S&P has been pretty good throughout, even with all that I said about the equal weight index not being up as much. The results are generally positive, so that's a good sign. The leading sector is not technology in the S&P 500, as you might suspect. It's actually communication services, which is up 16.5%, while tech is up just 12.2%. Utilities and financials are both up 10% as well. So there's been some quite a few sectors that are up double digits this year already. Commodities had a rough week despite an almost 15% gain in the price of natural gas. Did I say that? Did that just come out of my mouth?
It did, but wait a week.
Yeah, sure. The index was down 2.2% with oil, silver, and gold all falling. It was kind of a perfect storm for gold this week. You saw a rising dollar. You saw just everything that makes gold go down happened this week.
Mm-hmm. Plus, it was just going up.
It had been a little bit out of control. Yep. The bond market had a small rally this week, fed by falling interest rates. Rates actually did spike on the jobs report news on Friday, but not as much as they fell Monday through Thursday. So we saw a little bit of a bump in fixed income, which hasn't happened in a while. International stocks had a bit of a rough week, although it was weird because I looked at a bunch of individual countries and there were only two that were positive. And then I looked at the all world except U.S. index and it was up this week. I don't know how that happened.
I've been very picky lately.
One of the reasons that the index didn't do as well as it could have was Mexico. And they just elected their first woman president, which is cool. And it was in a resounding victory. I mean, the numbers were off the charts.
Yeah, and usually when you clone somebody, it turns out the same sex. But in this case, it didn't.
Yeah, she's
Obrador female.
Yeah, she was sort of handpicked by the previous president to be his successor. And the only problem with her is that she's a wacko leftist. Yep. So that is not going to be good. And the other problem was the country went overwhelmingly for her and down ballot as well. And so now they have a supermajority, it looks like, in their Congress or whatever they call it. And it looks like they can change the Constitution. Now, that is never a good thing for a country. And the results of that have been their stock market fell 11.8% this week. And well, the Mexican market had been doing pretty well, was up 50% in the last 3 years. Since the election, the market is down over 16%, and it doesn't look like it's done selling off.
Yeah, they're doing the bleed over from Central and South America, and all they have to really do is look at Argentina to find out there's a better way. Mm-hmm. Much more when we come back. We'll take a quick break and then get into it. Don't go anywhere. This is the Vanwee Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Vanwee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Vanwee.
And I'm Adam Vanwee.
And we have a trivia question, as usual. First, I'll remind everybody that the lines are open, 904-222-8255. Today's question brought to you, as usual, by Ken Bales at First Coast Alarm. You can call Ken at 904-636-7888. I'm about to get into a discussion about the jobs reports from this week, so I thought I'd orient a trivia question toward jobs. You know, there's been a lot of bragging lately out of the White House about, you know, this wonderful economy and job market and so on. It's not as rosy as some people would like you to believe. So here it is. How many more people in this country are working today versus 1 year ago today? And I'm not going to give you a hint yet. We'll need a target. If you listen to the White House, you'd think the number was really astronomical. And I will give you one hint. It's a positive number. So you got a bracket that starts at zero and goes to infinity, basically. All right. Jobs.
Yeah, jobs. It was an interesting jobs week.
Wasn't it?
Yeah. I want to talk before you get into the headline number on Friday. We saw the JOLTS report released this week, and that's another jobs report that's a little less known, but it's actually got some more interesting data, in my opinion.
Job openings, labor turnover. Those of you who are new.
Two things that really stood out to me. One is that there are now just 1.2 jobs per unemployed worker. That is exactly the same level as it was pre-COVID. Mm-hmm. That has been as high as 2 recently. So it's fallen, 40% or so? That's a lot. It's
called market forces.
Yep. There was recently 13 million open jobs or something like that. It was really up there. That has come way, way down. Yep. And it's
right
just,
about 8.
Yeah, aren't we? It's a different market out there now.
Yeah.
The other thing that really stood out to me is that the quit rate has fallen, and it's been falling dramatically. Yep. The quit rate shows how strong the job market is. People don't quit their jobs unless they have a better job lined up.
Typically. For a while they were.
Yep, that was true. But
when it's 2 for everyone.
Yeah.
And when technology is really booming and you're not getting massive layoffs of tens of thousands of people in that sector, there are a lot of people who are pretty comfortable leaving a job.
Yeah, because they knew they could get another one. Now, the quit rate falling like it has, that says to me people are not comfortable with the idea of getting another job or confident.
I put it at 68,000 or something like that.
It's the lowest level since 2018. So more than pre-COVID, like a year pre-COVID. Those two things really stood out to me, saying that this job market is not a 2 year ago job market by any stretch.
Nope. Well, there's always two sides to the story. When the first off, let's go to Wednesday when ADP came out, and ADP was what I call a Goldilocks report, not too hot, not too cold. 152,000 private sector jobs. That's a good month. It's a growing market. Everything would be fine. The market reaction to that was fine, as was Thursday when the JOLTS came out. That was fine. And then Friday, we got a number at 8:30 in the morning. It's shouted from the treetops. The economy created in May 272,000 jobs, which was 100 or so more than the so-called experts wanted to see. Because, of course, it means that the economy is so strong that there's no way we're going to get a cut in interest rates. So it immediately, the futures tanked and on and on. And then it started coming back. But then people started to actually do what I do right after the headlines are released, and that's read between the lines and underneath and on the other pages. What really went on in May? Well, the numbers do not add up. The 252,000 is the number that the Bureau of Labor Statistics puts out. And that's done by surveying companies. It's called the Establishment Survey. They call up the HR departments and say, how many are on your payroll today versus a month ago or whatever? And they get that number, and whether it's massaged or not at that level, I don't know. But I didn't believe that number when I saw it. And so, of course, I go out and try to validate it or otherwise. Well, after that comes out, they also have the secondary survey, which is called the household survey. That's where they actually call households and say, is anybody working? And I got a little bit different response from the households, because instead of up 272,000, the household survey showed a loss of 408,000 jobs. Now, I know that sometimes there's a lag in there. The household jobs supposedly pick up a lot of the self-employed and people with gig contracts and all that stuff. And there can be a little discrepancy in there. But first off, about half of that 272 number was government jobs and government subsidized jobs, meaning a lot of things in healthcare are subsidized. In fact, we'll get into that later in the show too. And the household is not likely to be quite the same. So it is a big difference. But then you've heard me talk for the last few years about the CES, the birth-death adjustment, which has nothing to do with people dying and living. It is an estimate that they do every month about how many companies are created and the people that work for them versus how many folded and people are losing their jobs. They say that this is a way to bring much more current information into the statistics. A lot of us say, yeah, it's a really good way to fudge some numbers, too. We really can't seem to say exactly how accurate that's been over the years. But the birth-death adjustment added 917,000 jobs for the month. And those are what some people call fake jobs or made-up jobs. As I said, I can't say for sure. But you put all these things together, and it doesn't make much sense. The CES birth-death adjustment for 4 months is 3,486,000 jobs in 4 months. Undocumentable jobs. How about that one? All right, for the month of May, the population was up 182,000, but the labor force was down 250,000. The participation rate was down 0.2. Now, this thing moves painfully slow. It usually doesn't move at all. Sometimes it'll tick up one, down one, but it fell 0.2 to 62.5. And in May, those of you who are Larry Kudlow fans, Larry's favorite gauge of all this stuff is called the employment to population ratio. And it peaked at 60.1%. I'm coming back to that one too. Unemployed people were up 157,000, so the unemployment rate went up to 4.0, which is the first time in months it's not been under 4. The black unemployment rate shot up 0.5%, and people not in the labor force rose by 433,000. Discouraged workers were up 100,000. The previous 2 months were reduced by 15,000 total, and the wage and inflation over 12 months is now dead even at 3.4%. Now, they'll tell you it's more than that, but when you figure in the wage increase times the hours worked, which are going down, inflation and jobs are covering each other exactly, except, as I point out so often, that's a pre-tax number. You got to pay taxes on the wages to buy those things that are in the inflation index. All right, if the Tax Cut and Jobs Act, the 2018 tax cuts, are allowed to expire at the end of next year, we'll all add $2,000 more to our expenses for taxes. This is not good at all. Now let's see the bottom line here. Part-time jobs in May were up 286,000, but full-time jobs were down 605,000. Every job created this year has gone to people who were not born here. Net job. You can't attach one job to one individual. But Americans have netted out a big nothing this year in the job market. This is not what you hear coming out of the White House, and it's not likely to change at any given time because it doesn't make them look good. But there is a significant change going on in our job market, and it is not nearly as strong as it looks. So if you got a job, keep it. And if you need one, get it right away. That's my advice, because you just never know. We talked a little bit on the way in, talking to Angela, about the possibility of a rate decrease. And we both think there might be one in September, but we both agree that there shouldn't be one all year. But if they start talking a little bit more about what's actually happening out there, probably the chances of a September cut are good. But if they do it, the bottom line is, it's 100% political.
Yeah, this none of this adds up with the fact that you can't go out to a restaurant without it being packed.
Nope. And can't get an airplane flight that isn't packed.
Everybody has money and they're spending it, and yet the bottom is falling out of the jobs market. I don't understand it.
That's why You can color us confused for the last 2 years because everything that we discover seems to be offset by something that's exactly the opposite.
It just makes no sense.
So where's the economy actually going?
I don't know.
I could throw a dart at a board and probably be closer than I would if I tried to weasel it out and figure it out from actual rational thought and data. But anyway, can't do that right at the moment. We'll be right back after a short break. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
And I'm Adam Van Wee.
And I remind you again, the lines are open, 904-222-8255. And the trivia question is still out there. How many more people in this country are working today than were working 1 year ago today? It's greater than zero, just so you don't think I'm trying to trick you into something. I want to say something that was just of interest. Who remembers the color photograph from years ago called Earth Rising? Remember that? It's like the moon rising or the sun rising, but it's called the Earth Rising. It was the first color snapshot taken of Earth from space. The guy who did it is a fellow named William Anders. He is a former Apollo 8 astronaut, and he died yesterday in an airplane, a Beech 45 airplane, that he was flying solo over the San Juan Islands when it crashed into the water. He was 90.
Wow.
And you just kind of got to wonder if he went out in style, because I don't know. But can you imagine that? A 90-year-old, he'd just done a, what do they call him, a loop?
What's a loop?
You up, over, and around. And then he crashed, and who knows? But you know, God bless him. What a guy. Another piece of interest. How many of you feel bad because you don't own NVIDIA since that's been so hot? Well, you might. Oh, got a phone call? I'll be right back on that one. Good morning, Mike.
Yes, good morning, gentlemen. I was, for the first time all week, out there trying to cut down some grass and listening to your show. Because the HOAs out here never fail. But
ruler?
Exactly. But I was totally overwhelmed by your condolences. So I wanted to thank you and Adam so much for that. That was very beautiful for you to do that on the air. She was a great person. She loved your show, too. She listened with me every Saturday morning. Great. And that was very beautiful. To everybody who listens to the show, not only is it one of the most informative shows regarding the economy, financial, and stocks, but they're also very personal people. So thank you.
We appreciate that. Thank you. And we always appreciate your calls and hope they don't stop now. There's no reason to change this direction. But always sad to hear things like that.
Yeah, your show will keep me going.
Good.
Believe me.
We'll do everything we can. You help us, we'll help you. Mutual back scratching.
Thank you so much. All right, let me let you go back to that. I hadn't, like so many people, woulda, shoulda, coulda. I had in a video once. It went up a little bit. I figured that's it. Boy, was I wrong.
Depending on what kind of an investor you are, you might be interested in what I'm going to say next. So just
very good.
Stick around.
All right, gentlemen, have a great weekend, and thank you so much for the wishes you gave me. Thank you.
Thanks,
Mike.
Okay, take care.
Call it part of getting older, but it's not one of the good parts, that's for sure. All right, if you feel badly that you either didn't buy or no longer own NVIDIA, there's a really good chance, if you're an investor that follows kind of what we do in the diversification world, then many of you own QQQ, which is the 100 biggest NASDAQ stocks, or the QQQM, which is exactly the same with a little different arrangement for taxes. And you might expect that NVIDIA would be a part of that, and you would be right. Now, NVIDIA joined the $3 trillion club this week. That's a pretty big number. Another one is Microsoft, and another one is Apple. So I looked at those big three, and here's the breakdown in QQQ. NVIDIA is 7.55%, Microsoft is 8.5%, and Apple is 8.18%. So if you own a lot, which means an even 100 shares of QQQ, your total value today is $46,296. In that, you have $11,217 of the big three. So don't feel like you're left out. You've got a really nice stake in it. We have a lot of clients that own QQQ and QQQM, and a lot of them own a lot more than 100 shares of it. So if you participate in indexing and ETFs and so on, and probably a few other places too that I didn't even bring up, you probably own a lot more of NVIDIA and Microsoft than you know.
Yep, no doubt about it. I also, just as a side note, if you own QQQ and it's in a tax deferred or a Roth or a traditional IRA, take a look at selling it and replacing it with QQQM. It's the same company, Invesco, that does both of them. And QQQ, because it's so old and one of the most widely traded and well-known ETFs, when it was set up as a unit trust, which is sort of the old version of an ETF from what I understand. QQQM is the newer version. It's an actual ETF, and it has a slightly lower internal cost. So over a long period of time, you'll do slightly better, and it's exactly the same.
And these days, of zero trading costs.
Yeah, it doesn't cost you anything to sell QQQ or buy QQQM.
And at the end of each year, you'll get one less piece of paper for your tax return.
That's right.
Pretty nice. I like it. One more quick note. This is just I keep a little list of tidbits that I find out every week, and when I find some interesting ones, I like to bring them up. Joe Biden was alive on D-Day. He was only a year old, pushing two. Who was the last previous president who was also alive on D-Day?
Oh.
Little brain tester
good
here.
Question.
Yeah, it actually makes very good sense when you think about it. But it was George H.W. Bush.
Oh, okay. That does make sense.
Yeah. Doesn't it? But you think, man, we've been through a lot in that time.
No kidding.
And we have since Reagan gave his speech and so on. But it... D-Day is kind of important for those of us who don't like speaking German. And just thought I'd bring it up. What the heck? All right.
I know you heard about this because I sent you the article this week, but there is a new stock exchange that is in the creation phase. And it's going to be based in in Texas, in Texas, yeah. Of all places.
Dallas-Fort Worth, I believe.
Yeah, and it's a couple of companies got together and are tired of dealing with the regulatory environment in New York, shockingly.
And, amazing.
Yeah, and the NASDAQ actually has some corporate governance requirements that are somewhat onerous and woke, and they're tired of it. And so they are trying to set up a new exchange in Dallas. And all of this sounds great until you look at who the two companies are. One, I was not surprised to see, Citadel Securities. Okay, that makes sense. The other one is BlackRock.
I know. I lost my breath at the same moment you did when that article came out.
What the heck? I mean, sort of the symbol of woke capitalism is BlackRock.
I'm going to speculate here. I think he's seen the light.
Maybe.
It doesn't mean he's going to change what he does a whole bunch, but he's going to change what he says a whole bunch.
We'll see. We'll see. I don't know. I mean, maybe it was all those surveys I filled out trashing them for being so incredibly dumb about that stuff.
If you want to do something about that personally, not on the big scale, but personally, if you want to look at an S&P 500 type index share, look at Strive Capital.
Mm-hmm.
That's the one that Ramaswamy started with some friends. And they are actively admonishing corporate CEOs as to their policies. And they've been very successful so far. They also have another one if you want to get energy sector exposure. They have one called Drill, and it's the same thing. They want the energy people who aren't going nuts about converting everything to green. They want to drill it and sell it, basically. So if you want to do your own part for that, those are a pretty good way to do it. If you read the Strive Capital website, you'll know a lot more about what they're doing. Just a little heads up. When this exchange gets up and running, I think we'll find out a lot more. But you are right. BlackRock in Texas?
Yeah. I was very surprised when I saw that name. I was not expecting it.
The next thing you know, you're going to tell me that Trump can go to Silicon Valley and raise funds.
$12 million, I think, he got out of the last visit.
You know, we've said this over and over and over, too. Americans come to their own rescue pretty frequently, but it's got to get real bad. That's what gave us a Reagan.
Yeah.
That's what gave us a Trump.
Yeah.
That's what gave us D-Day and on and on. If you trust Americans, you're not going to go too far wrong. It might irritate you a little bit on the way, but when push comes to shove, that is what will happen. So good luck to the new exchange, and I hope the success. It's just like what Trump said the other day. My revenge will be success. And I think that is one of the best lines ever. He who laughs last, you might say. And, yeah, we'll see. I'm going to stick my neck out very seldom on things like this, but I'm going to predict success in this case just because I think it's so timely. So we'll see, won't we? I've got a thing that's going to take a little more time than I want. People who deal with us, people who listen to us, and so on, you know that our investing style is what we call total return strategy, which means you don't just invest for long-term capital gain, or you don't just invest for interest or just for dividends. We do all of that. We want some dividends, some interest, on and on. I want to talk about total return strategy. I'm going to surprise Adam right after the break, I think. We'll be right back. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
And I'm Adam Van Wee.
And the lines are open, 904-222-8255. And the trivia question is out there. How many more people are working today in this country than were working on this day last year? And it's a positive number. That's all I'm going to tell you. So anybody wants to take a guess, and we can start bracketing. All right, total return strategy. Why do that? Well, you don't want to be a pawn of, for instance, a stock market decline, a sharp one, where instead of capital gains, you'll be getting capital losses, although capital losses are part of total return also, because we harvest those for taxes and use them to help people when April 15th comes. But we don't want to have only dividend stocks. We don't want to have only interest-paying bonds or whatever, or money markets, because you're never going to get an acceptable above-inflation return by putting yourself in a little cubbyhole like that. So reading this article today, Bill Gross. Remember Bill Gross, everybody?
Yeah.
He's one of the most successful people that ever lived. He says total return strategy that he pioneered is dead. So I shook my head and said, see, I mentioned I might surprise you. You're looking quizzical.
I don't even know what that means.
Well, I couldn't figure out why he would say it. Here's what he says you need to know. Yields are much lower than when he first coined the concept. Well, that's true,
okay.
Because he coined the concept when yields were about 16%.
Mm-hmm.
At about 4.6%, the 10-year Treasury yield compares with a peak of almost 16 in 1981. So if you want to put a time frame on it, there it is. U.S. debt requires the government to raise the level of outstanding treasuries by up to a net $2 trillion a year. So I'm thinking, let's see, what does that mean? If they have to keep adding treasuries and treasuries keep selling to people keep buying them, in other words, then as they buy them, wouldn't that increase the demand for treasuries and wouldn't prices rise? And at the same time, interest rates have been rising. So I'm still getting a little bit confused. So it apparently had to do with his objective. Instead of just picking up interest payments every month, he created the Total Return Fund, PIMCO Total Return Fund, in 1987. And he said, you have to do more than just clip coupons, and I absolutely agree. But apparently he was also timing the interest rate moves so they could play inside of the Total Return Fund. Rates are rising, then bonds are going to fall, so you sell them. And in order to capture the rising rates, you keep your bond holdings real short. And we were doing that for quite a long time recently when rates were just doing absolutely nothing. The bond bulls were fine with bonds going up and then taking those profits and putting them down. But yields over 5%, unlike in 1981, they're... Granted, they're not 16%, but they're what's the word I'm looking for? Sufficient, steady, sustainable, good.
Yeah, I mean, you're getting a decent
return. Yeah, you can balance your risk by owning money markets, treasuries, bonds, and taking that 5%. But you're never going to keep up on a total return basis if you only invest in bonds. So the bottom line on this, from what Gross was talking about, was he was focus only on a bond, being a bond investor. Well, I don't recommend that anybody ever follow that strategy. That's just nuts to me. Is that over time, the bond market is never, ever going to keep up with the stock market. It will in periods of time. For instance, we've had basically a flat bond market now for years and years.
Yeah. Well, the last 3 years, it's still, I believe, negative.
Yeah. And every time we pull that up on our screens in a client meeting, we still look at it and say, darn, it just doesn't seem possible that there's a negative return. It will change. That's why over time, the answer to a good investing philosophy is never to do all of something. It's diversify, diversify, diversify. Within your diversification, it's fine to change your bond durations and things like that. It's fine to move into different market sectors. But total return is not a dead concept.
So remember earlier in the show when you were talking about how the job market's been going down?
Mm-hmm.
Guess how many of the busiest travel days on record, of the top 10 busiest, occurred in May of this year?
May of this year?
Of this year.
Well, it seems like I'd be sticking my neck out, but I'd say three?
Five. Five of the top 10 busiest days of travel on record occurred in May of this year. That is how bad the economy is right now. Tell me how that works. I don't get it.
But you can be the most logical person in the world, and we really strive to do that. Things that we do, we like to think have a logical basis, and you can't figure this one out.
You can't. It just does not. It doesn't add up. I bet if you polled the people at random in the Atlanta airport who were traveling, they would tell you we were in a recession.
Yeah, you pick almost anybody off the street, and they're going to tell you that things are terrible.
No doubt about it.
And I don't know, things are not terrible for everybody, I guess.
Well, no, that is part of it. I think that I think the top 20% are feeling very, very good about their finances and their prospects right now. But the other 80%, I would say, are below average on where they're feeling about the economy and their personal situation right now.
I think you're probably right. It is a very confusing time out there. What we do know is that our total return strategy has been treating people pretty well.
It has been. It's been a good year. It's on top of another good year, on top of a really horrible year.
Yeah.
So
getting back. get some confidence back.
Yeah, but it's overall, I mean, that, you know, you're going to have a horrible year once every 5 years or so. So, I mean, I don't see anything in this market. People ask me all the time, how are you feeling about the market? How do you feel about the risks in the market right now? And honestly, right now, I just feel like they're normal, average, just like it always is.
I don't know if that sounds wishy-washy, but I agree with you.
Yeah. I mean, I think you've got a lot that could change drastically come January. If the election changes, you're going to see some pretty major policy changes in this country if that happens.
Isn't that the truth?
And you're going to see some pretty major policy changes if that doesn't happen too, and it's not going to be for the better.
That will definitely not be. I've been looking into a lot of that stuff. All right, we don't have much time left, so a couple little things. How do you keep your bank from closing your accounts? Every once in a while, you hear that there are waves of banks closing accounts, and you might not even realize it till you try to use a debit card or write a check and nothing goes through. Why and what do you do about it? Well, one of them is the fraud department. If you are dealing in cash with amounts $10,000 or over, you have to report that. The bank has to report it, called a suspicious activity report or just the 10,000 rule. If you start doing it over and over, then you get looked at. And if you don't even deposit or withdraw 10,000, but you have a series of deposits and withdrawals that are kind of consistently just under, then you're probably going to get tagged and they might freeze your account during an investigation. If you're going to do that, you don't have to subject yourself to that treatment. You can go to the bank and tell them why. And when they see it, then they'll look and, yes, there's a reason for this, and you're fine. So just know that one thing you do is communicate. Another thing, use your bank accounts. If there is no activity on an account for a long time, you can get put on a sort of a suspension type list where they're probably going to get around to closing you out if you don't do something pretty soon. So again, that's another one for communication. Another one, check all the bank messages. Banks communicate with you too. Don't ignore it if you get an email or a phone call if you know it's actually from your bank. And then keep track of your own accounts. Keep track of your activity. You know, online access to banks is everywhere now. Don't let anything weird happen in there without you reacting immediately. Don't write any more checks than you absolutely have to. But when you have to, use one of the new type ballpoint pens that has ink in it that is specially developed to adhere to the paper. It makes changing your checks fraudulently virtually impossible. So, yes, people could still get your account numbers and so on, but you're not going to get one of those things where you write a check and all of a sudden it clears for an extra $1,000 or whatever. So it's basically up to you. What you do to protect yourself is really up to you. So just be active. That's the big thing. Also, while you're at all this, think of what institution you're working with. And you really, really want to keep doing business with some of these big banks. There are about 83 of them that are in trouble right now, and there are others that are just plain not consumer-oriented to speak of. I refer you back, as I so often do, to Wells that got hit again for a big Ponzi scheme. I'm not picking on them. They just seem to be at the forefront of a lot of problems every year. There are now 376,000 people working in this country, more than last year, 376,000. Does that comport with what you have been told and what you've been hearing? To me, it does not. Every new job in this administration has been taken by a foreigner, net. We'll see you next week. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour.
AM 600 WBOP Jacksonville, 101.1 FM W266 CX Fruit.